This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Pick a Flick. I'm Dave Bond, normally from the Do You Expect Us to Talk podcast, but as Tony Black has decided to play Russian roulette with the future of his podcast here, he's put me in charge. So, tonight with me, I have with me, first of all, Stacey Taylor from Pop Culture's Parlour.
Hello, dears. And I don't know why I put on an accent there, because...
I don't know why you put on an accent. Where are you from?
Can you not tell? I'm from Birmingham.
Well, I gathered that, but I just thought, you know, whereabouts in Birmingham?
I'm actually from, like, the south of posher part, but...
The south of posher part? Because yeah, but my hubby... from Moseley.
Well, my hubby and his family are all from, like, Wensbury, which is why I've got a bit of a Black Country twang.
I thought that's why I didn't know, because they are different, and I lived in Birmingham once upon a time. So, joining her is Lee Grice.
Hello.
And how are you, sir?
I'm well, thank you very much.
So, without further ado, shall we go straight into it, folks, and see how we do?
Let's.
Okay. So, without further ado, let's pick a flick. First choice this week comes from at ZachLockwood96 on Twitter. He's nominated Frank, which is a 2014 comedy drama directed by Lenny Abrahamson and starring Michael Fassbender as the title character, along with Domhnall Gleeson, Maggie Gyllenhaal and Scoot McNairy. Now, either of you aware of the 1980s comedy character Frank Sidebottom?
Only in as much as I'm terrified of his big papier-mâché head.
Yeah. Now, this film seemed to be based on it, and then it bore no relation to it apart from the...
Big papier-mâché head.
Apart from the papier-mâché head. So, just to tell a little bit... tell listeners a little bit about this film, it's basically Donald Gleeson's character...
Yes.
Joining a band at a retreat led by the enigmatic Frank character, who never shows his face at all, and is commonly regarded by everyone around him as a genius. And every time we hear any music from this band, they're not really, are they? Let's hear a clip.
I'm Frank.
I'm John.
No. He has relationships with real women now. But it's hard, you know? He has to convince them to lie completely still, so, you know. Hey, don't tell Don I said anything. He might think it a shameful secret. I say tell everyone everything. Why cover anything up, right?
Can I ask you something?
Sure.
Why do you wear that?
You think it's weird?
Kinda.
Well, normal faces are weird too, you know? The way they're smooth, 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 and then, you know, all bumpy and holes. I mean, what are eyes like? Like a science fiction movie. Don't get me started on lips. Like the edges of a very serious wound.
That's true. But your head is still sort of intimidating.
Well, underneath, I'm giving you a welcoming smile. Would it help if I said my facial expressions out loud?
Well, maybe.
Welcoming smile.
Frank. You've been up all night talking to the keyboard player?
I'm not just a keyboard player. I write songs, too.
You write your own songs?
Mm-hmm. I'd love to play some for you sometime.
I really like that. Big, non-threatening grin.
Delighted look.
Okay, so that was, that was Frank. What did you guys make of it, Stacey?
Well, I absolutely ruddy adore this movie. Like, I love its tits right off. I saw this movie not really knowing anything about Frank Sidebottom except that he's scary because I'm a giant wuss. And so I thought this was a documentary at first when I went into it. And we got as far as them going to the retreat before I was like, Rich, this is... That's my husband, by the way. I was like, Rich, this is weird. And also, these people seem like sort of horrible. And I don't know if I want to watch the rest of this. And he was like, you know, it's not really about Frank Sidebottom though, yeah? And I was like, of course I didn't know that. And now that I do know that, I totally enjoyed the rest of the movie because I thought it was just a film, a really sad film about some mental people trying to do a music.
well, it kind of is.
Yeah, but I think when you realise that those people aren't real, because the thing about this is that it's a really difficult movie to try and sing the praises of, even though I loved it so much, because almost every character is unlikable. And like you say, I mean, I really love the music in it, actually. I kind of immediately just devoured the soundtrack. But it's a difficult one to talk about if you think it's real people, because you just think, well, this is an actual bunch of arseholes and I don't care. But once I realised that they weren't real people and this was basically a massive work of fiction, I think it has a lot to offer in terms of it asks a lot of questions about sort of the nature of mental health and the potential links to creativity and, you know, whether it's healthy for people with fairly obvious issues to be in a group together, and what it says about someone else trying to go in and change everything. And because that's essentially what Domhnall Gleeson's character does. He goes in and he tries to make the band what he wants it to be, which is like...
You've hit on something quite interesting there. One of the things I thought watching it this time, I did see it on release, so what's that, a couple of years ago now? So, but certainly this sort of cliche about the thin line between madness and genius. And, mm-hmm. I think this film kind of stomps all over that. We do believe that we're seeing somebody who is something of a genius, but because there's this sort of slight veneer of madness that everyone lives with because of the sheer quality of what he does. And it's only really on second viewing, when you listen to it, everything they're coming out with again, that it's all pretty crap. That he is just mad. And the growing interest in what they're doing is simply car crash TV. That's what it is. It's nothing to do with supposed genius. Lee, what did you make of this?
I hated it. I thought it sucked. It was... I was kind of traumatised because I know Stacey liked it. And when she asked me to come on and watch it, she said, but this is really good. You'll enjoy this. So I'm like, oh, okay then. And I remember Frank Sidebottom from the 80s, like when he was on, because he used to appear on like kids TV, like the Saturday morning TV.
Yes, I remember.
And late night channel.
Voice was very George Formby.
Yeah, he had this like nasal high-pitched voice, like from Manchester, that kind of thing. Which brings me, I was leaping slightly ahead, because in the film Frank's an American, so I didn't even realize Frank was speaking for a good 10 minutes. So I was kind of confused about who was speaking. because I was waiting for the high pitch nasal, you know, Frank Sidebottom voice. So I assumed it was the other guy. Was he their manager or something? I thought. So, but anyway, I was just really confused about who was speaking. And then I
the guy who ended up killing himself, Scoop McNairy's character. Yeah,
that's it. Yeah. So it became obvious.
He was one of the band. Yeah.
Yeah. So it was. So I was really thrown, and I was just. Because I knew nothing about it, to be honest. All I knew about it was back when it was first announced to be made, it kind of news broke. They're doing a Frank Sidebottom movie and Michael Fassbender's playing Frank Sidebottom. And I was like, well, that's incredible casting. That's just phenomenal. If he's assuming he's Frank Sidebottom.
Yeah.
So I figured it was either going to be a
Samuel L. Jackson is Zippy.
Yes. Yeah. So, I assumed a biopic, I guess, you know, and was just completely lost from the get-go. Because I thought, oh, yeah, because it started off, and I assumed it was going to be set in, like, the 70s, I guess. And then you've got, like, Domhnall Gleeson's character on Twitter. So I thought, well, this can't be right. So I was kind of waiting for a flashback or something, and I was literally just lost. And I was just... having like a horrible, almost like a breakdown partway through the film, just going, talking to myself, going, I don't understand.
Yeah.
I don't understand what's
going on. I was prepared for it because obviously I saw the sort of build up to its release. It was, for such a small film, it must have had a reasonably comfortable budget in terms of promotion, because I saw the trailers everywhere before it came out, which normally has... the bit where he's singing his most relatable song ever, or whatever the word for that is.
Oh, I love that song.
Which ends with him sort of spinning and farting. And so I kind of knew it wasn't really Frank Sidebottom. I heard it was Michael Fassbender. I knew Domhnall Gleeson would be sort of our surrogate in the film, the sort of viewer surrogate. So I went in fairly ready for what I was going to see. If anything, the hardest thing for me in this film was the sort of, was the last third. Because the film is tonally all over the place. For two thirds, I really loved it. You know, the family who turn up at the retreat, and he's dancing with the mother in the field and stuff like that. He's just obviously effortlessly charming, and it sort of adds to this whole surreal quality that disappears in the last third as you learn that he was entirely mentally ill and cannot cope with the stress of being put in front of the world.
Yeah, I mean, I think... I'm really struggling now because I feel like I watched an entirely different film. I think the whole first two-thirds of the movie were building up to the last third. And I think the reason why I love the film so much is because for days afterwards I was thinking about it and I was, like, farting about on Reddit and stuff trying to figure out what everybody else thought about it, because it's one of those films that, for me... it gave me so much to think about, and I was really unsure whether I'd even got what I was supposed to get out of it. And after faffing on the internet, I realised that pretty much there's like a bazillion different ways you can read this movie, and none of them are wrong. But I think it's difficult to watch, or it was for me at least, because I do have very minor mental health issues. And sort of watching the extent to which some people's mental health can affect their lives in general, and the fact that they all found each other, and Domhnall Gleeson almost destroyed it all for them, like, oh, it just broke my heart. And everything about that last third was just like, oh god, I was just so in love with the whole movie. I think Fassbender was mesmerizing in the very few scenes you see him without his head, without his massive head.
he was
acting talent. I think, to take your head off.
Well, yeah, two shame jokes going around my head as we speak. The thing with it was, is when they meet his parents, you are expecting that payoff of tragic childhood and everything else. No, not at all. He developed a fascination with masks. It was indulged by his parents. He had a happy enough childhood, and slowly this sort of mental health condition developed. And as I say, we're building up to this payoff to the thin line between madness and genius, and it actually turns out, yes, he has some musical talent, but his mental health has destroyed it. His mental health has got completely in the way of whatever it was he could have achieved.
But I don't know. So this is the thing where I come from. I didn't even buy the genius part. I didn't get that that it was, I mean, I think the film is a very much like a cinema trope in that it, you know, it's the typical band movie, you know, the rise and fall, you know, it's the Commitments and the Doors and all that kind of stuff, where you got the enigmatic front man, the talent, and, you know, you see the beginning of their rise and it all kind of falls apart at the end. But I didn't buy I never really bought the whole, the genius part of it. I didn't get that was coming over.
I think the only, I think on second viewing, you're absolutely right. On first viewing, actually, they don't play you a lot of music. You don't hear a lot. You hear bits and pieces, which is them sort of noodling around and like being, you know, and again, the sort of creativity, you know, that comes out of madness sort of thing. Well, they're doing some odd stuff, but who knows what they'll come out with. And the only time you hear sort of any lengthy bits really are, apart from on stage at the start, and where our attention is taken by Donald Gleason's character anyway, is him doing his most relatable song ever, or whatever it is. And you think, well, that's clearly not his style anyway, and he's just trying to be loved.
Yeah, it just didn't click. And also, I was trying to figure out if it was supposed to be funny, because there was a lot of kind of stuff you feel like could go either way. It was very kind of on the edge. Like their musical performance was like, were kind of, and the weird things they were doing, because they weren't using like conventional instruments and stuff. So they'd be just doing weird, strange noises and that kind of stuff. And I just couldn't figure out if I was supposed to be laughing at this or smiling inwardly or thinking these guys are just crackers and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. But I mean, it was quite a brave film in that, you know, they were quite happy to make the characters not fantastically likeable for the most part. In terms of the sort of tonal thing with it, what I found really, the film that came to mind, and it's not one that would immediately come to mind for most people, when we see him at the end and he's clearly a damaged individual, it reminded me of the bit of Shaun of the Dead where he suddenly has to shoot his mum. And you've been laughing all the way through, and it's like, oh shit, what's just happened to the tone of this film all of a sudden? And I felt like that a little bit about this. And whilst that gives the film something to say, it certainly muddies the water as to whether it's a comedy or not.
Yeah. I didn't feel like there was that much of a tonal change. Like, I mean, since then, I mean, I ended up Googling it halfway through to figure out what I was watching, kind of thing. Like, is this, you know, am I watching the right film for a start? And that kind of stuff. It was saying, oh, it's a comedy drama, and like the lot of reviews were very positive for it, but it got a lot of criticism for being funny for two thirds and the last third was depressing. And I thought, I'm not feeling that kind of joie de vivre kind of vibe at the start. Like,
you didn't feel the joy.
Yeah, so I wasn't
I was
feeling,
gonna say, I think the whole movie had an undertone of depressing,
yeah,
to be honest.
It just felt grim from, you know, from the guy. Was it the previous keyboard player who you first see freaking out in the ocean and being, I can't remember if he's being grabbed by ambulancemen or police or whatever. It's like, I was generally just kind of, I'm not sure if this is supposed to be funny or not. Because I was assuming it was, because it's Frank, or ostensibly it's Frank Sidebottom. So I was kind of going through it going, well, this isn't. It's not. I was kind of coming out from like, I don't get why this is called Frank, and I don't get why he's wearing the head, because it's not about him. It's not about the real guy. You know, it's not about like Chris Sivey, I think his name is. And it's not like a Mr. Bean movie. So it's not Frank Sidebottom as a character within the story. So it's not like it's not like that kind of a comedy. So I just couldn't figure out. It's just one of those films where you watch and you go, I don't understand why they made this.
Well, I mean, it was a Sundance film, so it's got a touch of the experimental about it, full stop.
Yeah.
It's funny you mentioned the opening scene of the film with the sort of keyboard player in the ocean. I thought that was setting us up for a Spinal Tap joke. You know, where their drummers keep dying?
Yeah.
But, obviously not. Anyway, that's Frank. Thank you to Zach Lockwood for referencing that. And that was our first picked flick tonight. So now, yeah, we move on to our sort of our close-up section, if you like. This is... What we're going to talk tonight is about, talking about Spinal Tap was actually quite apt, because just to talk a little bit about films about music, really, more than anything else. Not to be confused with musicals, necessarily, although there's some crossover. And the films that always spring to mind for me are the aforementioned Spinal Tap, because that is about the sort of absurdities of sort of hard rock and life on the road and image and all the rest of it. The other films that occur to me are the Blues Brothers. Because as much as that's a musical, it is about them sort of going on their musical journey, putting the band back together. And then I guess the third one I would always name is High Fidelity, because High Fidelity for me is a man's experience in life filtered through his experience of music and the soundtrack to his life. What are the films that sort of spring to mind for you guys, Lee?
Yeah, I'm not a big music-y film guy, but like I say, the one that I like, The Commitments, I'm a big fan of. The Blues Brothers, like you just mentioned, was a massive film for me in my teens. Spinal Tap, not so much. I kind of miss that. My Spinal Tap was the comic strip presents Bad News. That was kind of my Spinal Tap, in a way.
Yeah. Bad News, was that the comic strip one?
Yeah, that was the comic strip one, yeah.
Yeah, by the time I got to Spinal Tap, its hype was all pervasive. It kind of took to maybe its third viewing to really actually divorce myself from that and just enjoy it for what it is. Mm-hmm. Stacey, are there any films that you sort of think of in this subgenre?
Well, the three movies I wrote down were Blues Brothers, Spinal Tap and High Fidelity, so you kind of ruined that for me.
And then I said all three of them.
Yeah, yeah.
What a gracious host that I have.
But the other one that I toyed with for a little bit was Wayne's World 2. Simply because that film is ridiculous and it has an amazing soundtrack and it's kind of about music, sort of. This was hard because there's a lot of films that have musical elements but aren't necessarily about music. The only other film I can think of is Gemma and the Holograms, and that was absolutely awful, and I really wished I could gouge my own eyes out with a rusty spoon while I was watching it, but
It's funny because we were given, in preparing for this, we were all pointed to an NME article on 50 awesome music movies. And some of the choices in there were mad. I mean, Ferris Bueller. Is that really about music in any way, shape or form?
I suppose another one is Almost Famous. That's really good.
That's a really good call.
Yeah.
That is a really good call, because that is about experiencing that era and that era's music more than it's in any way a musical. But yeah, I just thought some of the choices were really strange. We did go out on Twitter for some sort of feedback on the sort of music films that mean a lot to people. Rodney Twelvetree at Fernby on Twitter, he suggested recently Straight Out of Compton, which I've still not seen.
Meaning?
All time, he said this is Spinal Tap, and he says Almost Famous comes in third. Good call, and one I'd actually forgotten. Andrew Brooker at Brooker 411, frequent guest on this show. He's put Kill Your Friends, Owen, Straight Out of Compton. Now, I've not heard of Kill Your Friends, so he might be giving us advice. Do you think he's actually naming a film or just telling us to kill our friends and by the way, Straight Out of Compton?
Yeah.
Matt Latham, at Excellent Matt, Wayne's World 2, so he agrees with you. I've not seen Wayne's World 2, I've only seen the first one, but I know it's he's trying to set up a music festival, isn't it, Wayne Stock?
Yeah,
okay.
It's bananas. It's typical Wayne's World bananas, yeah.
All right. Lee Scoville at Pork Chop Express, Almost Famous all day, every day. Again, I'm assuming he means the film and not that he's almost famous all day, every day. Phil Sharman at P.E. Sharman, Scott Pilgrim versus the World.
Oh, good call.
And this is Spinal Tap. And actually, just before we go any further, there are probably a good couple of ones to think of. Singles always sort of slips by me because it wasn't notably successful, but given my age, that's actually my sort of era, the sort of the grunge era. I was in my teens when that happened, and it did have quite a lot of cameos from Seattle bands with that early 90s look. You had like members of Pearl Jam in that, their screen band was called Citizen Dick. Scott Pilgrim versus the World, I'm less so sure about that. Would you agree that's about music? I've only seen it the once.
I don't think it's necessarily about music so much as it just features some really cracking musical scenes, I guess.
Because, I mean, a good soundtrack by itself wouldn't count. Otherwise, all Tarantino films are about music.
Good point.
I suppose, but to be honest, I haven't seen Scott Pilgrim since release, which has got to be about 6 years now. So, 365 Flicks podcast at 365 Flick Pods on Twitter. I know this is probably the most recent, but for me, it's Straight Outta Compton. Lee, have you seen Straight Outta Compton?
No.
No.
You haven't either. So that's all three of us haven't seen it. So we can really.
Well, that's yeah, good. So isn't
we,
it? That's...
we could make some shit out. It's good, isn't it? Emma Platt, at Dead Meat Emma, regular host of this show, she says, does Empire Records count? Yes, of course it counts. Empire Records is a really good shout, actually, Emma. Owen Hughes, at ohughes86, he's put 24-hour party, people. Plastic face can't smile the white out. Which is a reference I've missed, even though I've seen the film. Have you seen 24-hour party, people? I've seen it for a few years.
No, never seen it.
It's really good. It's worth seeing because Alan Partridge, that shows how much he's become his character. Steve Coogan plays Tony Wilson in it. So it's about the sort of Manchester's music scene, and he plays it a little bit Partridge-like. It's really good.
Mm.
Kevin White at Weak Lemon Drink, Control, and does Frank count? He's put, well, as we've just talked about it, Frank counts. Control's a really good shout. That's the film about Joy Division. So, yeah, good chat. And then we've got Maya Brooker, at Maya Brooker.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
He's put Empire Records. Love that film. Have either of you seen Empire Records?
No. I've never seen anything. That's the thing that... If you listen to my podcast, you'd realise that I'm almost constantly asking the question, have you seen this, with no.
All right, fair enough. Okay. And one from Facebook, Sean Wilson says, Almost Famous. So, yeah, Almost Famous, very, very popular on that list. Quite a lot for Straight Outta Compton, a few for Empire Records. And this is Spinal Tap. But as I think we've kind of exhausted your list, Stacey, are there any others you'd like to mention, Lee?
No, that's, yeah, like I say, I mean, Josie and the Pussycats, I definitely want to mention. How the Duck, clearly, you know, an underestimated genius film that's all about kind of
the film that taught us guitarists can get laid whatever species they are.
Yeah, so yeah, it's yeah, but yeah, I like music films aren't really my kind of forte particularly, but the ones I go for, like, you know, like the Blues Brothers are the ones I go. Blues Brothers was the one that kind of introduced me to soul and blues music when I was a teenager, so that's like a gateway movie there, really, for me, particularly John Lee Hooker, who appears, he's actually the only blues artist in the Blues Brothers. The rest are all soul artists. But yeah, that was that. Cause I was
some wonderful performances in it, though, from people at or near their peak. Mm. You know, you couldn't make that film now. But there's some really strange things in the list, as I say. The likes of Ferris Bueller, which I just find very, very strange. Pulp Fiction's listed in the list, and I think, well, that's not about music. It's just got a really good score.
Well, that's, yeah.
Or a really good soundtrack rather than score. But, yeah, interesting topic. Quite a difficult sort of genre to nail down, really. Good, for me, good music doesn't make it. It's about the characters and their experiences with music, which is what makes High Fidelity such an interesting film. Anyway, so that's movies about music. We're going to move on now and pick another flick. Four Rooms is a 1995 anthology comedy film directed by Alison Anders, Alexander Rockwell, Robert Rodriguez, and Quentin Tarantino. each directing one segment of the film that is in its entirety loosely based on the adult short fiction writings of Roald Dahl. How, I'm not sure. Especially Man from the South, which is the basis for the last segment, Penthouse, The Man from Hollywood, director Ben Tarantino. The story is set in the fictional Hotel Monsignor in Los Angeles on New Year's Eve. Tim Roth plays Ted, the hotel bellhop, and main character in the frame story, whose first night on the job consists of four very different encounters with various hotel guests. The film is set on New Year's Eve and starts with Sam, Mark Lawrence, the previous bellhop of the Hotel Monsignor, briefing his replacement, Ted, Tim Roth, about the job. Here's a clip.
Now, take a look at some of these goodies you brought us, okay?
Far be it from me, Chester, but I was just wondering if you could tell me, what is all that stuff for?
Hey, one thing at a time, man. I'm not a frog and you're not a bunny, so let's not jump ahead.
Very good, sir.
Norman, come on. I think you might want to look at some of this shit.
Hey, damn, Skippy. All right, man.
All right, man, tell it. A block of wood.
Continue.
Three nails.
Why three nails?
That's how many Peter Lorre asked for. Continue, Ted.
A ball of twine.
Well, that is definitely a ball of twine. Continue.
A bucket of ice.
You into it?
I'm into it.
All right, go on.
A donut.
That's for me.
A club sandwich.
That is mine.
And
a hatchet. A hatchet as sharp as the devil himself is what I asked for.
Well, sir, Chester, you be the judge.
No. I'll be the judge.
Careful, sir.
What do you think?
It's a sharp motherfucker. Get the nails and the twine. Bring all this other bullshit over to the bar. Come on. Let's go, Bruno, man.
You heard him, Ted. Go ahead.
Right you are, sir. Yeah.
So, yes, this film was nominated by Pop Culture Rewind, which is at Pop Culture Rewind on Twitter. So, Pop Culture and then RWND, if you want to find them on Twitter. They nominated this. So, I'm going to kick us off with, I'm going to postulate. Lee, Four Rooms is shit, discuss.
Yeah, it is. I actually wondered if I'd upset Stacey in some way. After she asked me to watch these, I thought, what have I done, you know, to make her hate me so much?
I came on for Masters of the Universe and Zardoz, so... But, you don't get any sympathy off me. You've got to wade through some right shit before you get any sympathy from me. Having said that, you are off to a cracking start with this one.
It's interesting because I'd never seen it until this week. And I'm a huge fan of Robert Rodriguez and Quentin Tarantino, yet I've not seen it before, which kind of makes me look back and think, well, I wonder why not. So it's obviously got some kind of rep to it that I've avoided it. Because I also like anthology movies as well. That's the other thing. Yeah, so I watched it and there's two good things about it, right? The first was the animated title sequence. I'm a sucker for an animated title sequence. And the second good thing I liked about it was literally almost the last shot of the film, which is the punchline to Tarantino's segment, the riff on the Roald Dahl story.
Did you say the last line?
Yeah, pretty much the last scene, the last section, almost the last line.
I see.
Like the punchline.
What was the last line?
Well, it was just the punchline to it was the Roald Dahl story is about a guy who creates a bet that he can flick his lighter 10 times and it'll light 10 times. If he does it, he wins a guy's car. If it fails to light any of those 10 times, he gets his finger chopped off. Now, in the original story, which was also adapted for TV, they mention it in the segment, it was adapted for Alfred Hitchcock Presents in the States, and it was also adapted for Tales of the Unexpected in the UK over here. And I've seen that version. It's a very, very tense story, and it goes through each of these flicks of the lighter, and it gets more and more tense each time. So if you know that story, then you come to the the Four Rooms version, Tarantino version. And what happens is very, very quickly, he does the first flick, it fails, and Ted chops his finger off, and then the credits roll. So it's boom, done and finished, and you're almost shoved at the theatre. Now, I like that. That made me laugh because it just said, oh, no, fuck that, and just carried straight on. Those are the two. So virtually the first thing and the last thing of the film I liked. Everything in between I thought was pretty awful.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, my normal gig is a Bond podcast, where it is at the moment. We'll talk about all our podcasts and different things at the end, but the moment you show me an animated sequence, I think of the 1967 Casino Royale, which is one of the worst notable films I can think of.
Yeah.
It's a complete mess. But then you think, well, maybe I'll get a Pink Panther film. This
well, that's
might
it.
Be all right.
Yeah, it's the Pink Panther vibe for me that it works.
You are right to say the film came with something of a reputation, because I do remember the sort of rise of Quentin Tarantino, if you like, and there was a point where everything he did had a degree of hype behind it, so people would go off and see him act in Destiny Turns on the radio because it's Tarantino.
Yeah.
But this film arrived stillborn. I mean, the word of mouth on it was toxic. We're only a year after Pulp Fiction. You know, there are four names there, you know, so if you don't like one of them, you might like one of the others. And I'll let listeners go and sort of look up their filmography, but there are people responsible for some very good films there. The thing that first struck me about the film is I've never seen Tim Roth act worse in anything.
Oh, see that chewy now.
I don't think he's particularly well suited to comedy.
No.
It's really scenery chewing. And the other thing, before I hand off to Stacey, is I thought the film looks absurdly dated for mid-90s. Now, some do. You go and watch Dracula or The Crow or anything like that, and they look resolutely early and mid-90s, respectively. But this film just looks so old and cheap. Stacey, what did you make of Four Rooms?
I think this movie is a steaming bag of smelly, cheesy dick tips. It's possibly the worst thing I've ever put in my eyes. And I've put a lot of terrible movies in my eyes.
Have you ever put dick tips in your eyes, Stacey? That's the question we're all thinking.
Well, that's what I've got the glasses for, you see, to avoid all of that. the thing about this movie is...
Do you practice safe sex? Yes, I put my glasses on.
They're like protective goggles.
Health and safety is important.
The thing about me is I'm not good with anthologies anyway, because I feel like anthologies are over too quickly. I don't get chance to get into the thing and get my teeth into a thing. So I was already a bit trepidatious about this movie. And then that soundtrack started playing and I wanted to jab my own eardrums out. And then Madonna appeared.
The score for this film's awful.
It's terrible. And then Madonna appeared and I was like, are you fucking kidding me, movie? What are you doing? What? Why? And then I got so cross through the movie that I actually spent £10 ordering takeaway cake just to cheer myself up.
I mean, I nearly quit halfway through.
Well, to be fair, that doesn't help. The first two stories are probably the worst. I mean, none of it's great. I mean, we'll get onto the various sections in a minute, but I mean, it starts with, I think, the worst of the four stories.
Yeah,
it's just a complete mess. None of the women can act in it. We've already established Tim Roth is terrible in this film. It's not funny. It's not interesting. A couple of them go topless, so you think, well, maybe it's meant to be sexy, but it's not that.
So either all should be topless or none of them should be topless. So
that's the thing as well. You can see who's got what contract, can't you?
Yeah, it's clear who's got the nudity clause in their contracts.
And at the end, one of them's got, like, tape over their nipples. So you just think, it's like, well, don't do it then. There's a no nudity clause.
Kind of...
Don't go nude and then put tape on yourself. That doesn't happen.
Yeah.
I could have done without the whole section, to be honest with you. And the other thing is, I mean, anyone who listens either to me on this show or any other podcast, like, I'm no stranger to being quite lewd. But I have to say, I thought the whole trying to get some jizz storyline was astonishingly pointless and tasteless.
Yep. Pretty much.
It was. And it didn't go anywhere as well. There was no twist. You know, it needs to have a twist.
There was no twist. It ended up with Amanda de Cadenet coming out of the water.
I know. Talk about dated. Yeah, Amanda de Cadenet in it. That really dated it. That was like, holy crap. You know, so talk about resurrected. wanted, but it was.
I mean, they could have got some better quality spunk and maybe got Danny Bear out instead. not a very good section. Then we go on to the second section, which confused me all the more, to be quite honest with you. You've got Jennifer Beals tied to a chair and her husband threatening and Tim Roth being accused of having had an affair with her. And Tim Roth goes into massive, massive overacting mode, hanging out a window and all the rest of it. What is the point of this?
I don't
sequence?
Know. And the thing that I wanted to ask was, because I didn't know whether I'd just like slipped into a coma and missed a bit, but that woman who's tied to a chair, she ends up in the end sequence, like with Quentin Tarantino and his buddies doing the whole finger chopple off thing situation. Like, how, why, how, huh?
There is some drop dialogue to it, like she's escaped or she's on a break there or something. It's definitely the same woman, and as I say, it is dropped into the dialogue, not overly memorable because I can't remember. But that's the second sequence. Then we go on to the third sequence, and I just think tonally, what is this film? The first film was some women with their tits out and a story about sperm and witchcraft, and the third story is misbehaving children.
And a dead corpse in a mattress.
That
apparently smells of feet.
Fetish for feet. That was really creepy because it's kids sniffing each other's feet and lots of close-ups of kids' feet and stuff.
Yeah, this isn't Quentin's sake sequence. Quentin directed the one that he's in at the end. This is Robert Rodriguez's section.
I think they've hired
the director of Desperado and From Dusk Till Dawn. Well, he's about to do From Dusk Till Dawn next, actually. And he's delivered them that in a sort of hybrid with one of his kids' films. Mm. And none of it really works. And the big joke appears to be that the father, Antonio Banderas, is a real tough, no-nonsense guy. And when he comes back and they've destroyed the room, he barely notices.
Mm.
That's all that build-up is
Do you know
for.
What disappointed me about this section is the fact that I was sort of live-tweeting my disdain for this movie as I was watching it because that was the only thing keeping me from committing suicide. And a lot of people were saying, don't worry, the best section's coming up, the third one, the one with Antonio Banderas, that one's cracking. And I was thinking, oh, cool, something to look forward to. Yeah, and then it happened, and I was like, nope, this is trash. What are you all on something? Like,
yeah, that was... See, the third one was the weakest one for me because it just...
Because those kids are terrible.
Oh, I don't know. It's which aroma of turd do you want, really? You know, none of them are any good to this point. I still think the first one is the most amateurish, but none of them are particularly good. And then, of course,
at least the third one had a punchline, you know? It had a... there's some shake to the story.
I suppose so, yeah.
You know?
It's really strange. You get these little bits in between... That are just, you know, remember Sammy Jenkins bit of this film, you know, cuts to something seemingly unrelated. And then we cut to the penthouse sequence. The Man from Hollywood, Quentin Tarantino's playing a famous director, and he's got a group of hangers-on, including, you know, actors, agents, and everything else. And they call Ted up to join them at the suite. This at least has a little bit more flair. The camera's constantly moving. And for such a dreadful actor, I thought Quentin Tarantino actually suits this fairly well.
Yeah.
Admittedly, he's playing a director, not much of a stretch, but...
this
section at least was passable.
Yeah, it was watchable at least, I think. It wasn't agonising to get there. The previous segments were really, actually proper hard to sit through. You know, you kind of, you know, really are just ticking off the minutes going... Okay, it's a 90-minute film. How long is each segment? Let's get the clock on it.
You can see what they're thinking. Do you know what I mean? That, you know, it's distributed by Miramax. It's Quentin Tarantino's production company, A Band Apart.
Mm.
And you think, well, you know, let's get the bright young things. This new generation, they're all producing really interesting work. When you throw them together, it'll be even more interesting.
Yeah.
And what you end up with is a mess. And they seem very straitjacketed by. The format. There's no idea there that's fun. That's organically developed.
No.
What you've got is the straitjacket of room in a hotel. Go.
Yeah.
And it's almost like none of them really had any ideas what to do with it, but they've got to produce something.
Yeah, it felt like a vanity project to me because this came after Pulp Fiction. It was almost like They went to Tarantino, like, do what you like. And he just got his mates in. I mean, I don't know if he's friends with, like, Alison Anderson and Alexander Rockwell. I mean, I know he's friends with Robert Rodriguez. But it just felt like a chummy film school type exercise. Like, there's, apart from Tim Roth, there's no real star to it. It's just a succession of cameos. Like I say, as bad as Madonna is in it, she's literally in it for like 30 seconds. And everybody's just in it for 30 seconds. There's no...
Madonna won a Razzie for Worst Supporting Actress. Now, Madonna is a dreadful actress. But did she do anything in this film? I mean, if you didn't recognise Madonna...
Mm.
Or I mean, you wouldn't know she was in it. Yeah. I know that sounds silly, but you would not recognise that character at all.
No.
Just to say, its critical reception, it's got 14% on Rotten Tomatoes.
That's too high. That's too fucking high. Who's doing that?
That's a bit too high. And it says most reviews agree The Misbehaviours is the best of the segments. Well,
okay. That's the worst one.
Tim Roth was praised by critics and audiences for his performance
as a Christmas ham.
Did they think he had special needs and they were like, well done, Tim. Good job, little buddy.
I feel like I should actually describe my notes, because this movie was so bad I could barely write anything about it that was worth writing. And pretty much it says, Section 1, Honeymoon Suite, ugh, Madonna. Then it says, Section 2, The Wrong Man, crappy nonsense. Section 3, The Misbehaviours, obnoxious kids, shit, when will this end? Then it says, Penthouse, eh. It pretty much sums up my entire thing about this movie. Directly underneath that it says, I hate this, I wish I wasn't watching it anymore.
So we're just grateful you nominated it.
Yeah, thanks,
you,
man.
So before we go, before we move on from this film, let's quickly rank the segments then. Let's rank the different shades of shit. Which order would you put them in, Lee?
I think the Tarantino one was probably, and I hate to use the word best.
Least shit.
I think, yeah. Then probably something, probably The Wrong Man, maybe second. And then The Missing Ingredient, and then Misbehaviours, I thought was really just atrocious. It get worse.
That was your worst one, so you put Missing Ingredient third.
But really, just the whole, just Tim Roth needs to be taken out and really just put in his own little segment, because he was just...
Originally, it was meant to be Steve Buscemi in that role, and I cannot think he would have done any worse with it.
No, I'd assumed he'd have been a bit more restrained. I thought they were they're clearly going for like a Chaplin thing, but I thought, maybe Lee Evans was supposed to be... cast in it, or I thought I could see Lee Evans carrying it off. But he's like at the start, it starts off like he's supposed to be silent because he doesn't speak in the first scene. So you think, oh, they're doing the bellboy thing, the Jerry Lee.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which they reference.
Which completely undermines when he does speak.
Yeah.
I've got no dog in that game. I don't care if this film is silent or with sound, but they kind of hedged their bets and changed their mind, you felt, didn't they?
Just unlike the way his accent changes as well. Like half
the time. It does when he's on the phone. It does when he's on the phone at one point. He just suddenly goes back to like the Tim Roth we know.
Yeah, Thomas thing, and then he goes Cockney. And then he's got the weird walk and stuff. It's like, I don't even get what they're going for.
I don't know. I would certainly give the sort of, I wouldn't even give it praise, but I think The Man from Hollywood, the Quentin Tarantino sequence, at least looks like it was directed by a professional. And for one of only a couple of times in his career, Quentin Tarantino was in the right role. The rest of them, I think, are rock bottom. I would certainly put The Missing Ingredient, the first one, last. But yeah, they're all pretty bad. So thanks for that, Pop Culture Rewind. We're very, very grateful. So once again, just before we sort of sign off, I'd like to thank Zach Lockwood at ZockLockwood96 for his nomination of Frank, and Pop Culture Rewind, that's at Pop Culture RWMD for Four Rooms. Everybody who commented on our Movies About Music section. And that only leads me to say, Lee, where can we find you on the internet?
I'm on Twitter far too much, at lovelylee_g. If you want to check out the archives of the podcast I used to do called Small Press Big Mouth, you can find them at smallpressbigmouth.blogspot.com.
And what was the gist of that podcast, Lee? What will people find?
About small press and indie comics. So it's good.
Stacey, where can we find you on the internet, and where can we hear your
bloody everywhere like a rash on a cheap hooker? I am at Stacey's Parlour on Twitter, and you can find the podcast either on iTunes or at popcultureparlour.podbean.com. I'm actually trying to promote at the moment the fact that I'm going to be doing a 24-hour live broadcast for charity in July. I don't know why. It's going to be hard. but come and listen to that and throw some money. That'll be broadcast over Mixlr. That's mixlr.com/spcp-live. And that's on Saturday, July the 9th. So, yeah, that'll be certainly a chronicling of my descent into madness. But the pop culture...
Don't miss it. Seriously, last year's
been epic. I don't know if it was epic for all the right reasons, but it certainly was an experience. But I'm trying to raise money for Alzheimer's Society, so any donations and listens and downloads would be very much appreciated. And yeah, the parlour's basically about anything under this massive pop culture umbrella. And I also do a podcast all about the Ninja Turtles, because why not, called Podcast in a Half Shell, and that's at popcultureparlour.podbean.com as well.
I did well to come back to concentrate on that rest of that conversation, because you called yourself a cheap hooker and then you said Stacey's Parlour.
Do you know, you wouldn't believe the number of spam bot sexy people I get following me on Twitter. Like, look at my tits! And I'm like, I don't want to! My eyes.
Send them to me. I'm okay with that kind of thing.
I was going to say, send them to us. We'll sort them out. So thank you for both of you for joining us.
Well, thank you, Emily, and just I want to just say to the listeners, don't worry, we're from the Midlands. There's nothing wrong with your ears.
Well, there might be something wrong with your ears, and listening to people from the Midlands won't change that. So that was Pick a Flick. You pick a flick, we talk about it. Simple as that. Good night, folks.
Coca-Cola, lipstick ring, go dance all night, dance all night. I've got dancing legs. Woo! They won't stop the dancing, no, they won't stop the dancing. Kiss me, just kiss me, kiss me, Nefertiti. Just the way you like it, just the way you like it. Kiss me, lipstick Ringo, that's the way you like it.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.